We welcome you to this audio series intended to provide information to those eligible for Air Force legal assistance, which include active duty military members, their dependents, and retirees. Our hope with this series, which we are calling The Art of Law at Hill Air Force Base, is that we can convey legal assistance information to you that is readily available, provide information that is responsive to your needs, and to do so in a timely manner. This series is for information purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for legal advice from an attorney. Today, we will be discussing wills. My name is Brad Bell, and I'm joined by two of my colleagues, Mr. J. Ed Christiansen and Mr. Darren Johns, both of who have significant experience, both as active duty JAGs and civilian attorneys, dealing with legal assistance matters. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Brad.
Thanks, Brad.
One of the services our office provides is wills to those who are eligible for legal assistance. Prior to doing those wills, we ask the client to fill out a will worksheet so we have a better understanding of how they want their property to be disposed of at their death and how they want other important family matters handled. The purpose of this podcast is to help our clients understand the will process and the decisions they will be asked to make when they have their appointment and to go over terminology and concepts that they might not understand. So, J. Ed, why don't you tell us, what is a will and why would I need one?
I'm happy to answer that question. A will basically is a document. A lot of people use the term testamentary. It's a testamentary document, meaning what happens to your stuff when you die, that you can tell the whole world what is going to happen with your property. Understanding wills, it's important to understand what happens to your property if you die without a will. Every state will have intestacy laws. Intestacy, if you die intestate, that means you died without a will. There may be some differences between the states, but generally the principles are the same in every state. In Utah, the first question that's going to be asked if you die without a will is, do you have a surviving spouse? If the answer is yes, then the following question is, do you have surviving children? If the answer is yes to that, there's a third question, that is, are all those surviving children of yours the children of your spouse? If they are, your spouse gets everything. If there's at least one child that is not your spouse's, then we have to look to the details of the state we're talking about, and every state will have some sort of mathematical formula as to who gets what. In Utah, the surviving spouse gets the first $75,000 of your property. Then there's a mathematical formula to divide the rest between your spouse and your children that is not that of your spouse. But although when we look at the scheme of how Utah and other states divide your property, most people, and when I say most people, that doesn't mean that this is the correct answer for you, but most people pretty well follow the same pattern or scheme that the various states do, but not everybody. Despite that, even if you want to give your property the same way that the state would if you died without a will, in my opinion, it's probably best that you do have a will, because it's best that you decide what happens to your property. And it is possible, although not frequent, that state laws can change with respect to what happens to your property. But deciding what happens to your property isn't the only thing that you can do in a will. Of course, you're going to appoint people in certain fiduciary capacities. When I use the term fiduciary, it's kind of a blend between legal obligation that deals with money and looking out for the best interest of the estate. You can appoint trustees, you can appoint guardians, and I'll come back to that in a second. You can appoint executors. And depending on how complex your will is, there may be other positions that you appoint somebody to. But I do want to specify the issue of guardians. If you and the other parent of any of your children, if they both die, you can appoint who's going to be who takes care of your children, the guardian. And the huge benefit of doing this in a document such as your will is, depending on the state laws, you can expedite the process of the court approval of whoever to be your guardian. If you don't appoint a guardian, then the process becomes longer and could end up in contested cases. But if you appoint somebody, that really expedites the process. In fact, it's just a paper exercise and there won't be any court appearances. Did I answer your question?
Yes. Thank you, Jay. But maybe just a little clarification. When a guardian is appointed, that is somebody that the person who's doing the will is designating as the individual they want to take care of their children. But what are some of those responsibilities that a guardian would have once they're appointed?
Essentially, the guardian is going to have the same responsibilities as you as the parent will have. You're completely legally responsible for them as if you are the parent.
So I know that many clients come in here with the idea that they want a will, but they've also heard about something called a living trust and want to know what the differences of those are and what are your recommendations with regard to wills versus trust?
Okay. Well, first of all, trusts are good things. Well, let me actually explain what a trust is. Essentially, a trust is some sort of fiduciary arrangement. Here I use that word fiduciary again. It is a fiduciary arrangement where a third party who is titled the trustee will hold on to your assets on behalf of whatever designated beneficiary, whether you're the beneficiary of the trust or whether children or somebody else are beneficiaries of the trust. The trustee holds onto the property according to this fiduciary arrangement that's reduced to writing with all the rules and principles of the trust. A lot of people, as you'd mentioned, have been told that everybody needs a trust or you better get a trust to avoid probate. And although there is some truth to those statements, not everybody has to have a trust. There's certainly no legal requirement that you have a trust. And even if you do get a trust, you still need a will because trusts don't cover everything, no matter how careful you are. And you may, after the fact, acquire more property that is not included into the trust. But with the concept that you have to have a trust to avoid probate, that's not exactly true. As I mentioned already, you're still going to have a will. And the law firms that produce trusts for you, they will still create what's called a pour-over will, disposing of property that for whatever reason didn't get placed into the trust. But when I was in private practice, I litigated more trusts than I litigated wills that were in probate. And this was before a probate judge. And these trusts were litigated for the same reasons that wills are litigated. Maybe the executor isn't doing what they're supposed to in the will. By the same token, the trustee might not be doing what they're supposed to in the trust. But again, there's still the possibility of litigation in a trust where...
Yeah. So, Chad, you just mentioned executor. Can you explain what an executor is so that our listeners understand the difference between the executor and the trustee?
Yes, of course. As I mentioned before, in a will, you can appoint people to various fiduciary capacities. An executor, or more commonly known nowadays as the personal representative, is the person who will take your will and do what you instruct in the will. If you say Johnny's going to get 50% of your estate, the executor, who could be Johnny or could be somebody else, will give Johnny 50% of your estate and then follow the rest of the instructions. It's just the person who accomplishes what you direct in your will.
And a judge is the one who has to actually appoint or confirm that person in that role, correct?
Yes, only if the will has to go through probate. And that's one of the points why whether or not you need a trust or not. Not every case has to go to probate. If you die with an estate less than $100,000 and you don't have real estate, you don't have to go to probate. And there is a process in the Utah's law in most states. It's called small estate administration, or you can go to the bank and the DMV with affidavits, and they will, with these properly created affidavits, they can give you the property that was in the account or title of the car in your name.
But getting back to what you were discussing earlier with regard to trust, are there certain circumstances where somebody absolutely should consider getting a living trust?
There are certain circumstances. Well, first of all, I don't recommend getting a trust simply to avoid probate because in Utah, probate is a non-issue. It's a $300 filing fee where a lot of people think it may be some large percentage of your estate, and that's not true. That might still be true in two or three states, but in most states, no, and definitely not in Utah. There are four circumstances that I do recommend people consider a trust. That doesn't mean that I think they should get a trust, but they should at least consider it. One is if they have an estate exceeding $14 million. If you have more than $14 million, it's very possible and very likely that you may have to pay estate taxes, thereby reducing what your heirs will eventually get. If you have real estate in multiple states, I recommend you consider getting a trust. Because despite the fact if you die in Utah and you go through a very simple Utah probate process, but yet you've got some undeveloped property in the middle of the Mojave Desert in California, Utah can take care of everything you have except the real estate in another state, which means California is going to require what's called ancillary probate to distribute or dispose of that piece of property. And California probate is significantly more difficult and complex than Utah probate. So if you place that property into a trust, then probate may become, well, will be easier to dispose of that real estate without having to go through ancillary probate in multiple states. There's a third circumstance that I recommend considering a trust, and that is if you have a blended family where you come with children and assets and your new spouse comes with children and assets. With the will, some people are able to come up with a distribution plan that makes sense and is fair to them, but it is difficult. And again, I'm not saying go get a trust. All I'm saying is consider a trust to figure out what might be fair in distributing and perhaps property being available to the surviving spouse for the rest of their life and then distributed in whatever plan to the kids. And then lastly, there's a fourth circumstance that I do recommend, or that I do recommend considering a trust, and that's where you have a disabled child, disabled and has qualified for government benefits, usually Medicaid, which is welfare of a type. And because if you qualify for Medicaid, but then all of a sudden get your parents, one-fourth of their estate, that may disqualify you from further government benefits. And so trusts are created that that disabled child's share could be held in trust and dished out to them, but not to the extent that it would disqualify them.
Are there different types of trust?
Trust can be divided into two categories based on when the trust is funded. Funding a trust means you transfer the assets, like retitling the deed of a house into the trust. A living trust is funded when you create the trust. That's why it's called a living trust. It's created and funded during your life, and the assets are transferred into that trust. And at our office, in fact, DOD-wide, we don't do living trusts, not because anybody thinks living trusts are a bad thing. Living trusts can be a great thing. It's just that they're complex enough that for our transient clients and our transient attorneys, it's difficult because trusts need continued maintenance. But we can offer what are called testamentary trusts. Here's that word, testamentary, dealing with being testate or intestate. Your will is called the last will and testament. So you hear that word testament or testamentary or testate has to do with dying, with or without a will. So a testamentary trust means it's a trust, or at least some trust language, that's inserted in your will. And that trust that's created by operation of your will does not come into operation, nor is it funded until your death. Based on the instructions in your will, some asset or some money or property is held by a trustee that you appoint, and that trustee distributes to whatever beneficiary you designate according to whatever rules you dictate. So we do offer, as a service of part of our wills, is to insert testamentary trust language. Frequently, if you don't want your kids to have your estate before until age 25 or whatever, we can create that trust in the will. Or if you have a special needs child that you don't want to disqualify them from further government benefits, we will include the rules that won't disqualify them.
That's great. Thanks, J-Ed. Darren, we've talked about a lot of the assets that pass through the testamentary will, but are there assets that don't necessarily go through the will and are probated? Can you discuss some of those?
Yeah, sure. So there are a lot of assets that people have that don't necessarily go through the will. For example, thrift savings plan, 401ks, savings accounts and checking accounts that are pay on death beneficiaries or designations. Those would not pass through the will. They're what we call non-probate transfers. So a lot of times you say, well, I'll have clients that will come in and they'll say, hey, I want to give 40% of my TSP to this person in my will. And I'll have to advise them, well, you don't do that through your will, but what you do is you go to your TSP plan and you designate a beneficiary. And that's how that beneficiary will get that money, is through what is designated on the TSP plan or on the SGLI, your life insurance. Those all have designated beneficiaries. And those designated beneficiaries will receive the money from those assets regardless of what the will says. So the will has no control over those assets. Other things that we'll see commonly are homes. If a home is a title, it is a joint tenancy, then that is a non-probate transfer, meaning that when one of the joint tenants dies, the other joint tenant gets the entire property.
So that's interesting, Darren. So what will the document actually say if somebody wanted to go look at the title on their home or their cars? What will they be looking for to determine whether or not it's in joint tenancy?
There is language on the deed. You can look up the deed and it will say joint tenant or JT tenant on the deed. And that's how you can find out if it's joint tenant. Another document that has come into use here in Utah is called a transfer on death deed. Transfer on death deed allows you to, upon your death, transfer your home outside of the will to somebody that you designate on that transfer on death deed. And the nice thing about that is that during your own lifetime, you still control the house, the property, and you can sell it if you want. If you sell it, it voids the transfer on death deed at the point that you sell it. So you still have control during your lifetime. But you can designate outside the will who is going to get that home upon your death. Where that comes in handy is a lot of times I see folks will come in and say, well, I want to put my child onto my deed as a joint tenant so they can have the house when I pass away. And my concern with that is that when you do that, then that becomes that child's property as well. So should that child later get divorced or have a car accident or get sued for anything, that's their property at that point. And you could lose your house because you've now given it as a joint tenant, or at least they would lose their portion of the house because you list them as a joint tenant. Whereas with the transfer on death deed, they don't have any interest in the house until you die. And so there is no house to divide up in a divorce or to lose in a lawsuit. So that's where a transfer on death deed can actually become more beneficiary than a joint tenancy.
Very good. Now, in our office, not only do we provide the wills and such, but we do offer other documents that are very important for an estate plan. For example, advanced medical directives and powers of attorney. Can you just describe briefly what those are so that our clients understand what they're getting when they come?
Sure. So, first of all, let's talk about the powers of attorney. We have a general's power of attorney and special powers of attorney. A general power of attorney basically gives somebody the authority to do anything that you could do on your own. You give them the authority to have wide discretion over all of your assets. They could buy a car in your name or sell a car in your name. So you want to be very, very particular about who you give that power to. It needs to be somebody that you trust who's going to manage your estate effectively. But that general power of attorney is very important, especially if you have like a history of in your family of dementia or Alzheimer's as you get older, because it allows that person with that power of attorney to handle your estate even while you're still alive and to be able to pay your bills and make all transactions for you. We also have special powers of attorney where instead of giving somebody such broad power over your life, you could say, you know what, I'm deploying. I want you to be able to take care of my car, maintain and upkeep my car, register my vehicle while I'm deployed. You can give them a power of attorney that allows them to do just that one act. A special power of attorney will do that for you. And then we have what's called the healthcare powers of attorneys or advanced healthcare directives, sometimes called a living will. I don't like the term living will just because too many people confuse it with the testamentary will. So I tend to use the term advanced medical directive. And that, because our medical conditions are so important, is not covered by general power of attorney, which is why we have the healthcare power of attorney, the advanced healthcare directive, where you can choose somebody to make medical decisions for you when you're unable to make those decisions yourself. And in these advanced medical directives, you can choose to say, hey, this person can make all this, have full discretion to make whatever decisions they need to make when I can't make it myself. Or you can limit their decisions. You could say, I want this person's decisions to be to keep me alive at all costs. Or I want this person's decisions to be to take me off life support if certain conditions are met. But if those conditions are not met, then they keep me on life support. So it allows you to designate somebody whom you trust to make those vital healthcare decisions for you. And it doesn't have to be life and death decisions. It could be something such as, hey, you're going in for a shoulder operation. You're going to be under anesthesia and you want somebody there to be able to talk to the doctor and help make decisions should something happen or something come up. Or it could be you have a child who has just turned 18 and is getting used to the world and still trying to figure things out, and you're still paying their medical bills. And so they want you to be able to have access to their medical records so that you can look at their medical records, and you can look at their medical bills, and you can pay their medical bills for them while they're in school. But you would need a healthcare power of attorney or advanced medical directive to do that, because our privacy laws, namely HIPAA, would otherwise prohibit those medical providers from discussing your 18, 19, 21-year-old child's medical records with you without such a document.
So you raised an interesting point, Darren, with regard to powers of attorney. I just want to touch on that just a little bit. Sometimes we'll have clients come in and say that their parent is starting to decline with their mental faculties and such, and they're wanting to quickly get a power of attorney done in that child's name. What are some of the considerations that you as an attorney need to be thinking about before you grant such a request?
That's a very good question, because a lot of times we do have people thinking, oh, I need to get a power of attorney so I can act for my dad or my mom. And they think that the power of attorney is theirs to get. It's not. It is the person who is giving that power of attorney. It's theirs to give. It's not the person receiving it who comes in to get it. So that means that the person for whom you need a power of attorney needs to meet with one of the attorneys in our office. And the attorney in our office is going to have to assess, one, is this person capable? Do they understand the nature of their action? If they still are able to understand what they're doing, then they can sign a power of attorney to whomever they wish to give it to, whether it be their son or their daughter, you or whoever. If they no longer have that capacity, you know, if they've already been committed to a nursing home because they no longer are able to care for themselves and they can no longer think mentally clearly, and they no longer understand what's going on. at that point, it may be too late to get a power of attorney. At that point, you're probably going to have to go to court and get a guardianship established. So when you realize that this is something that's starting to occur, starting to happen, that is the time to come in early and get those powers of attorneys set up so that when the time comes, they're already in place and you can step in and take care of the needs of your parent or whoever it is for whom you need that power of attorney.
Thank you, gentlemen. This information has been very helpful and hopefully will benefit our legal assistance clients as they contemplate having their own wills done. If any of our eligible legal assistance clients have questions regarding this topic, please call our legal assistance office at 801-777-6626. Thank you for listening.